This interview is sponsored by WooFoo. Do you have an embeddable form or survey on your website right now? If you did, you'd be able to collect information from your audience and use it to build your business. Go to WooFoo.com right now, and for free, you'll get embeddable forms and surveys. WooFoo.com. It's also sponsored by Shopify. Many Mixergy listeners are telling me that they heard me talk about Shopify, they went online, they created their store, and now they're up and running with a new store from Shopify.com. Don't you have an idea for a business, for a store that you want to get up and running? With Shopify, within minutes you can have it online, and within weeks you can start interacting with your customers. And they'll make it easy and give you all the tools you need to grow your business. Check out Shopify.com. It's also sponsored by Grasshopper. It's the virtual phone system that entrepreneurs love. If you had a Shopify number right now, you'd be able to get calls no matter where you were in the world. You'd be able to set up extensions for the people in your company or virtual extensions to give the impression of size, maybe one for a sales department and an IT department and any department you want. Get all those features and so many more. Check out Grasshopper.com for a full list of all the features that they have at a reasonable price. Grasshopper.com. Here's the program. Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner, founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. Today I've got with me Heaton Shaw. Heaton Shaw is the co-founder of KissMetrics, which is an analytics company that gives web-based businesses actionable metrics. Now here's why I invited him here. I saw a video, Heaton, that you did for Startups Lessons Learned, the conference that's going on this week with, I guess that's Eric Ries's conference. And yep. There are a couple of lines in here that just intrigued me, and I said, we got to do a long interview on this. Here's what I wrote down from that video. You said, in 2003, my co-founder and I started a consulting company doing internet marketing, search engine optimization, and social media marketing. We tried building 20 different products. Most of those 20 products failed because we really didn't think about our customers when we were thinking about the products. And then you talk about how the lean startup philosophy helped you have a hit product with KissMetrics and how it changed the way that you're building. What I want to find out in this interview is, what are some of those products that you launched? Why didn't they work? What are your startup lessons learned as you built those different products? And then talk about lean startups. I know the lean startup ideas. I want to see them through your experience, how they actually work at a real business. How does that sound to you, Heaton?
Yeah.
Cool.
Sounds great to me.
Okay. All right. So The consulting company that you guys founded was what?
It was called ACS. It was ACSSEO.com. The site's still live. We basically started doing search engine optimization and social media marketing and all that kind of stuff, and got into just wanting to build our own products so we could build a more scalable kind of revenue stream. Mm-hmm. And so we hired, I think it's 70 to 100 different developers or contract development shops to try to build stuff for us. My co-founder and I realized we were at a disadvantage because we were not technical. Mm-hmm. So we had to learn really fast on how to deal with kind of that aspect of building web-based products. Then that's why we started hiring people. And it was because we had the money to do it from the consulting business. My story is basically we built, I think it's over 20 products at the end of the day. I'm actually speaking tonight at the Lean Startup Circle event about this with some of my KissMetrics team. So I actually have this deck out right now. So I'll make sure you get it, Andrew, later so you can post it up. But basically, a number of things we built. One was we built with a development shop as a partner, we built a podcast advertising network. So it was called Fruitcast. There's still a splash page up. Let me give you guys some stats. This is some stuff that if you guys are coming tonight in San Francisco, I'll also be talking about it. But basically, we built it in 2 months. We outsourced the development, spent $45,000 to build it, and we launched it in November of 2005. Mm-hmm. And Arrington actually wrote about it, and he pointed something out that we didn't know, which was bad. He said, for how much we were charging advertisers, he said, that's a hefty $250 CPM to the advertiser, which is way above what radio stations charge for ads. We didn't know that. We should have known that. And he knew that. So Arrington was smarter about our business than we were. I think some of the lean startup principles would have helped us avoid all of this. Like, I'm pretty sure we could have spent less than $1,000 and came to the conclusion that we ultimately came to, which is we Deadpooled it in October of 2006. So I think what's that, like about 6 months? Oh no, almost a year later. Basically, a line in the email from one of our partners was, "I was sincerely hoping we'd find some magical combination of events that would jumpstart it." So we were waiting for magic to happen, and it didn't happen. And we wasted about a year and $45,000 on that idea, it failed. We're still ranked for podcast advertising on Google, though, or whatever that's worth. So that was, I think, one of our kind of, I would call that a small to medium failure. Another failure, which I'm not going to talk about tonight, is actually a hosting company. We spent $500,000 trying to build a hosting company. Bad idea. I don't know what more to say. It's just a bad idea.
Why? Why was that a bad idea?
Ton of investment, ton of effort trying to do it. Had no idea about the space. We were very focused on the wrong thing. So we were focused on server infrastructure and all this kind of stuff, when really we should have been focused on what actually is a product that makes sense in the market. So I think companies that have done well in the hosting market are Media Temple, as you know, Andrew, I'm sure you're going to love that plug right now, Slice Host, and a number of other companies that actually figured out what the opportunity is and really built a product based on that. I wouldn't say any of them have built an awesome product necessarily, but they've been able to win market share because they understood customer needs. So I think, and plus not understanding how much investment it would take to make a successful hosting company back then, which was, 05, 06. Those are things that we didn't understand then. And that was a significant hit. Like, I think that was probably our biggest fail, because we spent $500,000. And in hindsight, I could have, knowing what I know now, I could have tried building 100 things with that money and then had 10 of them be pretty successful.
Okay. I would like to now, this is what I do here on Mixergy. I really dive in and I dissect everything that people say to the point where if you're not a real entrepreneur, you're not really into business, the next part of this program is going to be boring. And if you are, I think it's going to be extremely useful. Let's start with Fruitcast. I want to understand two things. Where this money went, and I want to see how you built this out. And then the second thing is, now knowing what you know about lean startup philosophy, how would you do it differently today? So let's start off with, you guys are two developers, two non-developers. People in the audience are asking, who's the business partner? The business partner is Neil Patel, who is your brother-in-law. You're married to his sister. Okay, $45,000, you've got a consulting company, it's your own money that you're investing. How do you find the developers to build this out for you?
That's a good question. We had money, so we weren't bootstrapping, so to speak. We had money from building, our consulting business and charging people for consulting. We were able to scale that. We were good at that. So we had money to spend, which I think most people don't necessarily have when they first start. And because of that, we just tried hiring people. So we tried, hiring people everywhere we could. We tried looking at all the development shops that were out there, and we just picked them and said, "Want to work on a project with us? We want to pay you." And it was as simple as that. But like I said, we had money. Today, if I didn't have money and I was doing this, I would probably take a different approach and validate a lot of my ideas first, so that when I, and this is as a business person, completely non-technical, I would validate my idea first and then have a lot of information around the customer, the needs, and maybe even have some prototypes built.
Let's slow it down. I'm sorry, Heaton. I want to slow it down and understand how the wrong way unfolded so that we can identify it. Because believe it or not, even though we understand lean concepts, lean startup philosophy, I know we're all going to get stuck in these traps at one point or another. And I want us to see ourselves in the story that you're telling here. So you had money. Before you had a business and customers, you went out and you hired developers to do this for you?
Yes.
Okay, and you hired them under what basis? Was it development shops that you hired to build out the whole product, or was it employees that you took on and you said, we'll definitely grow this, so we need them full time?
Development shops that we hired just to build out the initial version one is what I'd call it.
Okay, and how did that go? Were they able to take your idea and actually give you a finished product?
So $45,000 later, in 2 months, we had a finished product. It was a pretty substantial finished product. It was a podcast advertising tool. Podcasts can go and sign up and basically have the tools to create their podcasts. And the advertisers could come in and buy the inventory, so buy the ad space that they needed.
And when they bought it, would it automatically be inserted into the podcast?
Yes.
Okay, so you mentioned Media Temple, which is my hosting company. If they use the system right now in the middle of the program, they could have their ad inserted.
If it was live.
If
it was live. Yeah, we shut it down in 06.
Okay. All right, so that was it. Were you guys podcasters yourselves?
No.
Where did this idea come from then?
We had a list of ideas, and we always have a list of ideas being business people, and it just happened to be one of them. And the shop that we chose got excited about it as well. So for us, it was really important when we picked development shops or designers or whoever it is, specifically outsource, to make sure that they're excited about the opportunity as well. Because usually you get more out of someone when they're excited and passionate about it, truly. So we would always go to these shops and give them 3 or 4 options on what we wanted to build.
Okay, 2 months, $45,000, that doesn't seem like that much.
Mm-hmm.
It's up and running, it's also not a long time. Michael Arrington shoots the first hole in the business, but you know, you always take your product to market and you get negative feedback that you can adjust by. Were you able to adjust based on that feedback?
Yes, we did, but I felt dumb. Because it's something I should have known before I even pursued the idea at all. It's something I could have known for cheap or free. And if I had known that, things would have been much different. I probably wouldn't have wasted the money.
Oh, really? So this model just didn't work without the high CPMs?
Yeah, it wasn't going to work. There's a number of reasons it wasn't going to work. Some of them having to do with the way MP3s are distributed and all this kind of stuff. And the way audio files are distributed, and the fact that iTunes is probably the only one that can make a lot of money on this. There are a number of reasons that we realized as we got into it, but these are all things we could have understood way before. So another example is, you know, which is what Andy pointed out, is the fact that radio stations, we could have mimicked their model more if we understood it. We didn't even bother to understand it. We didn't go out to these advertisers first and say, hey, how are you advertising on radio? Are you even interested in podcasts or anything like that? Like, there's a lot of things we could have done that were free to cheap that we didn't do.
I see. Okay. All right. Can you give me one other one? One other thing that you could have done differently?
Yeah. So with podcast advertising, it's a marketplace. We need the podcasters, and we also need the advertisers. And so what I actually would have done, very related to what I just said, is actually I would have done 2 tracks of what they call customer development. And basically, there's a number of ways I could have done this, but let's just take the podcaster. Those are easy guys to reach out to. There's a lot of folks like you and other people, you know, especially even back then that were doing it. There were several businesses built on just having all those people there. So we could have went to most of those popular guys and said, hey, we're trying to build a better way for you to monetize, and just ask them some simple questions. With the phone, a SurveyMonkey survey or whatever it may be, and basically got some answers around what their needs were. Were they okay with putting advertising in? How long were their podcasts? All these kind of just little minute details that we didn't know about, quite frankly, at all. So that would have gave us a better idea of one part of our model, because it was basically like a marketplace, right? And it's a very challenging. I typically probably would never do a marketplace again. Or try something like that, because you have to please 2 types of customers. Then what we would have done is went to advertisers. We probably would have went to bigger advertisers, which would have been harder to get to, and started talking to them about how they buy ads on radio. And that, I think, like I said, would have been harder to get to, but we would have only needed 3 to 5 of them to give us a pattern of data. And I'm always, at this point, I'm always hunting for patterns. What are patterns in basically these customer interviews that I would do that I can basically turn into products or learn from?
Okay. You mentioned customer interviews. You mentioned looking for patterns. Let's talk about how you would use all these different ideas today. Heat and Shaw looks at Mixergy and says, hey, Andrew's doing these videos. It's growing. It's getting good attention. Leo Laporte is just crushing it with his Twit network. I see that there's now a growing area here, growing business here. I don't want to invest $45,000 in the space. I want to just go out and figure it out and build it out leanly. What do you do today? Right now you have this idea. What's the first thing you do?
The first thing I would do is the way I would approach it actually is like just identifying those 2 different groups. So you're the producer. Excuse me. You're the producer, and then there's advertisers. So one thing I would do is I'd go look at all the producers out there and see who's advertising with them already. And then I'd go try to talk to those advertisers, because I feel like those are the people that are ultimately going to have the money and they're the ones that are going to help the producers monetize and help us be the middleman to do whatever we can there. So for me, the person spending the money is number one important. And then the producers, I'm assuming I can get them, right? I'm assuming I can get them if I'm going to offer them money, which I think is a pretty good assumption. Would love to prove that out, but I think if I offered you more money, you'd take whatever product I have, most likely, as long as it kept your customer experience the same. So then what I do is I'd go to Media Temple, I'd go to, you know, Leo Laporte's advertisers, I think he's got some big brands as well, and try to reach them and find out why they're advertising, what benefit they're getting, and understanding what they might need. And then I'd use that to figure out what type of product to build on that side of the business. So do they want automated placement? Is there a certain type of placement, pre-roll, post-roll, all that kind of stuff that they want, and figure out what their needs are? And then I would go to folks like you, Leo Laporte, you, whoever else makes sense, and try to understand what your needs are. I think one of them that I can imagine is that and these are two different products at the end of the day, but you probably could use a better video platform. Not talking shit or anything on the one you have, but you might be able to use that. And there's probably certain little nitpicks that you have. So I'd really try to find the patterns in that across multiple kind of people, I guess, vloggers. Like you, and try to understand if I can build something better to hook you in. It might be like provide analytics. That's always a good cookie in these types of businesses. Most people provide analytics as a way to get all these producers or content providers or publishers, and then have the kind of advertisers come in now that you have, you know, a mass of these kind of producers. So that's probably the first thing I'd poke around in and see. And it's not just because I'm in the analytics business, but it's because that's a typical thing, and that's basically how it's done. Probably provide you with a video platform. I think that seems like the fastest, easiest, low friction thing, and really learn about what your needs are around that, and then kind of go from there.
Okay, but at the heart of it, you'd be doing interviews with people on both sides. You'd be calling my sponsors, WooFoo, Shopify, Grasshopper. Why are you advertising with Andrew? And then you'd call up people like me and other people who are doing interviews and find out what are our pain points, what's bothering us, what could we use. And you'd be prodding certain areas that you assume that we'd be interested in. Like, do we want a new video platform? Now, that I can tell you, if you were to ask me, I wouldn't want a new video platform, not just because it's my sponsor, but because it's a headache and it's embedded so deeply into all my work that to switch would just not be worth it.
Sure.
But maybe you talk to a couple of other people, they say the same, and they save you trouble. And that's what you're saying here. You want to spend time having those conversations.
Yeah, and you want to start with your assumption. So that's the part I kind of skipped. Everything I talked about is basically an assumption that I would have about these two parties that I need on my platform, so to speak, or in my business. And I would start with these assumptions. So one assumption is one that you just invalidated for me, which was that you need a video platform or a better video platform. It sounds like you're happy with what you have. So then I might go dig in deeper and find out if the platform you're using has APIs. If that's a way for me to do business, right? I actually am a big fan of the platform you're using. I love the analytics they provide and the little heat maps. But yeah, so I might have done more research already and kind of came to you with a better proposition. I think the video platform thing is something I could have, an assumption I could have invalidated or validated myself before even talking to you. So I like to do some of that upfront work. It's not market research. It's more of customer research and really trying to understand and be intelligent when I talk to you, right?
Okay, and by the way, I use Wistia for my video platform, not just to plug them, but I think you can go now into this interview and see the analytics and see what people are rewinding to listen to, what are people skipping that Heaton and I are talking about, and so on. Why analytics? Why would you be looking for analytics in whatever product you are interested in? Can you talk more about that?
You mean looking for analytics as in what I mentioned about...
As the first solution that you'd be giving me or anyone else to get into our world. And I do see that, by the way, that people who want to get into the mobile space, they look for an analytics hook to get in and then they continue to do business. Why?
It has more to do with the business type. So if you're running a marketplace, you have to give something away for free. And a marketplace means there's two parties, right? So I would say that the simplest, easiest platform, which we've historically seen work, is giving analytics for free in return for the, you know, for your usage of my product or usage or me hooking into your business. If I have analytics and I understand more about all of you publishers or producers, and then I can go to an advertiser and say, here's who I have, here's who their audience is, let's, you know, let me help you reach that audience. And that's typically how it works. I mean, it's worked in the Facebook app space. It's worked in even with Google Analytics, so to speak. Like, they're giving it away for free so that, you know, a certain percentage of those people can improve their ROI, and then they can use AdWords. You know, that's the real reason Google Analytics exists, is so that they can make more money on AdWords, which is their ad platform. So I think people, that's the first place I'd go for in this type of thing. That being said, it really depends on the business.
Okay.
It highly depends.
So the first thing you would do in this new business that you and I are creating is go and do interviews with as many people as you can.
And before that, I'd probably list out my assumptions.
List out your assumptions, then go do interviews.
Yeah.
Now, what about this? One final question before we move on to the next step.
Sure.
I know that at Kissmetrics, you have some pretty big names, pretty big brands who are doing business with you. Those aren't people who you can just pick up the phone and call randomly and ask them to spend half hour on the phone teaching you about their business, is it?
LinkedIn is very valuable. And there's a lot of ways to reach a customer. I mean, I can go on for days about this, but it really, again, it depends on business type. So, and the businesses I tend to lean towards are ones where I can put up a survey or a landing page and I can just buy traffic and send people through it. That way I'm not worried about like talking to big brands or anybody like that. So I tend to skew towards those type of businesses because it's easier to buy customers online or buy traffic and kind of watch them take your survey. That being said, I would say, like I said previously, LinkedIn's your best friend. So if you go for their subscription service that allows you to mail people, you can basically go in and mail people. So if I want to get at the brand manager at Logitech, right? They're on LinkedIn. I can email them, or I can see who in my network might know them, right? And then if I'm paying for LinkedIn subscription service, I can go reach them. Another thing is LinkedIn's Q&A platform, their questions and answer platform, is very powerful. So I might ask my network, a question there. I might even use Facebook. I might even use Twitter and go, oh, does anyone know anyone like this? So I think if you know, I hate to put it like this, but maybe I do like to put it like this, but if you're an entrepreneur, you're trying to do a startup, you're gonna do whatever it takes to get to the next step. And in this case, the next step is reaching a potential customer and talking to them. So, you know, if you can't even figure out how to do that, then maybe you need to go ask somebody.
Okay. All right. That makes a lot of sense. If you're going to really be building a business or launching anything new, you're going to have to make phone calls to grow that thing. If you can't make phone calls to even find out, where you don't have to ask people to take money out of their wallets to help you out, then you shouldn't really be in business because you won't be able to take it to the next step. You also mentioned surveys. When you say interviewing, do you mean just interviewing on the phone or in person and having conversations like that? Or are you also talking about putting up a survey and asking questions like that? Would you and I, in our hypothetical podcasting business, put up a survey to talk to sponsors and podcasters?
I would do both. So I think the advertiser is gonna work out better on the phone because you're talking to brand managers and people like that. And if anyone's ever tried doing sales, it is not actually that difficult to get on the phone with someone for 20 minutes. So you just have to figure your way around, maybe bug their assistant. If you have to go drop by their office, have a little, bring them lunch, whatever you got to do, right?
Uh-huh.
But that doesn't need to scale too far, right? You only need like 5 or 10 of those interviews with these brand managers or media buyers, and you'll understand what's up. On the other side of it, with the podcaster, for you, you know, I'm guessing you have limited time. You're trying to, you know, hustle yourself. I might just say, hey, can you take 10 minutes and take the survey for me? I'm really interested in building a product for you and helping you make more money. And usually that works pretty well. And then I just build a survey based on my assumptions and just based on understanding more about kind of you as a customer.
Okay. All right. Let's continue then. We talked about writing down and being aware of your assumptions, doing some interviews, doing some surveys. What would you do next? This is Heat and Shaw a few years after the mistake. Now you're going back in time and recreating the business in a smart way. What's the next step?
I would actually try to find the patterns in those surveys and try to understand if I want to continue or not. It's likely that in this business, I wouldn't continue. That's just my hypothesis, simply because Trying to make publishers' money is difficult if you don't have advertiser relationships. So there's not a huge scale of people like you that are bloggers. So there's not like thousands of them as far as I know. And so I think I would realize pretty fast that I'd have to go after the 100 that are huge, right? Like you, and maybe there's 100 others, maybe there's 200 others. And then it would be a game. To me, it would be like, okay, you know, based on these assumptions I have, which ones are wrong, which ones are right? And do I have more questions now or more assumptions I need to make based on these responses? Do I need to go follow up with Andrew? Do I need to go follow up with, you know, some of the kind of brand managers and figure out like if I need to know more information? If I don't and I've discovered something, like I discovered, for example, let's say a video platform would work. I might go figure out how to build a minimum viable product, which is basically putting the least amount of effort to give you something you can use, so I can actually get you using it and figure out from there, based on usage, what's right and what's wrong.
Okay. All right. So let's assume you've gone through this. You're realizing that, and actually before we continue, before I make that assumption, what I thought was interesting about what you said earlier was you wouldn't decide how to proceed. You would decide whether or not to proceed. And that was unexpected for me. I thought you were going to say, there's always a way. I just now have all this research that's going to show me what that way is. No, you have to stop yourself and say, there's a big option here, and that option is to stop.
I mean, it's also, you know, a lot of people think that the lean startup stuff or even doing a startup is, you know, you can kind of, there's two different camps. One is, oh, you have a vision, you're going after the vision, you have your blinders on and you're just doing what you got to do to get there. Another one is that like, oh, I'm just going to go do market research and figure out what I need to do. I kind of fall in the middle ground. And I think that that's what guys like Eric Ries will tell you, which is like you need a vision, and it needs to be, you know, it needs to be something that you're passionate about and things like that. But you need to be able to kind of bob and weave as you discover what the opportunity is and as you do these interviews. So I think, you know, it's very easy now after all these failures and also some successes that for me to say, I have this vision, I have this idea, but I'm willing to admit that I'm wrong about certain parts of my vision, and I'm willing to change it because my goal isn't to see this vision realized. My goal is actually to build a successful business, which doesn't mean that it means I'm going to be wrong a lot, but it also means that if I'm taking this approach where I'm okay to be wrong about parts of my vision, then I'm at least headed towards success versus being really stuck on, no, I'm going to help these vloggers make money. You know, I'm going to get all of them and I'm going to figure out how to do it. Well, yeah, you can do that, but you might fail if your assumptions are all wrong and you're not really trying to learn along the way.
Okay. All right. Let's continue with what you and I could do if you were to recreate this business. Then we'll go back and talk about some of the other businesses that you launched. And then I'd like to end it with going through KISS metrics and seeing how you did it right. Because you talked about how Eric Ries's ideas helped shape KISS metrics. And I got so curious about more and wanted more details. So let's continue here. All right.
Sure.
You decide and go, no go. You make that decision, you say go, and you realize what the opportunity is. What do? What's the minimum viable product?
For the blogger thing, or just generally speaking?
Let's use this as an example because I understand ideas better with examples. Not that I want to get into this business. People sometimes think that I ask questions because I want you to run my business or my next business for me. No, I just think that examples make ideas a lot more, a lot easier to understand and take away. So then what would the minimum viable product be here?
Yeah, so let's make some assumptions and say that they were true, right? So let's say the assumption is you need a video platform, right? As a blogger doing these interviews and stuff, and there's enough of you out there, right? So there's 100, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And as a business based on the surveys, as an entrepreneur, I'm confident I can reach all of you. Because based on these surveys, I would know whether I can reach all of you or whether there is a strong enough pattern amongst all of you where I can build something. So let's say the pattern is getting these videos up, hosting them, you know, running them the way you want, doing the live streams and all that is difficult. And that's what we discovered. So I would try to figure out how I can spec something out that would get me to step one of, understanding whether that somewhat proven assumption is true. And the way you can do that is, personally, I'm always about kind of ghetto rigging things in the beginning if I can, and then also finding that early adopter. So it might be before you pick the platform you have. Let's say this was before then, you really had this need. What I'd probably do is help you with as little technology as possible, use YouTube, believe it or not, and string something together that's more useful than what you have today, right? Maybe I'd hold your hand on it. This isn't the final product, but now I have, I'd start with some assumptions I have based on those surveys. The one assumption is you want a video platform, you want it easy to be able to stream, and you also want the videos to be archived, right? And you would like some analytics on it, right? So I might even string together something between Justin TV and YouTube in this case, because you do these live interviews and that's a big deal for you, and then literally manually take the Justin TV videos and put them on YouTube. Because I might even realize that you want a bigger platform, and YouTube might provide that for you. So let's say there's a bunch of assumptions there. I would basically, cobble together a product and give it to you.
Okay. Now I understand this. This means you don't go out and spend $45,000 before you understand what you're building. You first test it out, and then the money goes to building the better version of it. Carnegie in the audience is asking, why are we talking about video here? And I'll tell you why. Because I think it shows why it helps us understand the idea, but also it helps point out this issue. Heat and Shaw, you're a guy with a big reputation in this space. I would want to work with you as a podcaster because of your reputation. If you came back to me with this reputation and said, Andrew, I'm going to give you this ghetto rigged YouTube Justin TV solution, I'm going to laugh. I'm going to say, this is the guy who I'm supposed to be working with who's giving it to me?
Yeah,
that's why a lot of people wouldn't go with this minimum viable product, wouldn't create it.
Yeah, that's a good point. So I'm looking for people that would go with it because they're my early adopter. They're the ones that buy into my vision for the business. So they're not necessarily buying into what I'm doing today, but they're buying into what I'm trying to build for them in the future. So this is my early adopter. So if you're not someone that wants to go after that promise and needs that so bad, you're not an early adopter for me at this stage, and I should move on and find someone else.
What about your reputation? What about the reputation of your business? If it starts off with something that's ghetto rigged, whether it's this YouTube thing or something else, doesn't it take away some credibility?
No. I mean, if there's enough customers out there, let's say you have 1,000 customers in this space, and if, 10 of them, 5 of them don't like what you cobble together for them, but they still believe in the vision, that's okay. I mean, there's still a lot more fish in the sea. So I think you shouldn't be scared of, launching something really buggy or crappy. I mean, honestly, with Kissmetrics, what we're doing today is when we have a new feature we want to launch, it might take 5 days to make it really polished, or a day to release something really fast and buggy so we can learn. I want to maximize my learning at every step, and I'm not worried about making everything perfect anymore. And that statement is extremely hard for me to say. I'm a perfectionist.
Okay, I want to come back in a bit and talk about that. Let's go on to the next step. You've got your minimum viable product. What happens after that? You get your feedback from people and then?
So you get your feedback from people, and you determine, again, you step back and say, based on this feedback and what I'm looking at, whether it's maybe at that point you're looking at metrics, maybe you're looking at some surveys, or even just knowing based on interviewing customers and seeing the patterns, knowing whether you want to continue at that step. I think at every step, especially at the minimum viable product step, it's like, do you want to continue further or not? And really basing that on validated learnings from your customer. So I would really figure out if you're finding the platform useful. There's probably a feature list that you want to make it more useful. Or it might be that we cobble it together, you use it, and you're like, you know what, it doesn't really matter to me. So then I might start back at square one and try another minimum viable product that's a little bit different, and then try that on you or some other customer and see where I go. And that's basically what you would call a pivot. So I would take what I've learned here and figure out what the next step is. Either I'm going to double down on this minimum viable product and build it into a real business and a real product, or I'm going to pivot and try a different angle. So for example, one pivot could be, we think that the tools are great, but someone like you is too far along or sophisticated to use them. So we might pivot and say, we want to build something like Justin TV, for example, for the common person, or there's some problems with their product that we discovered. And so we're going to take the same technology and apply it to a different type of customer. That's what they call like a customer segment pivot. So it's the same product, but you're the same MVP, but you're tuned it towards a different customer.
I see. Okay. And then is there a next step after that, either double down or pivot?
Same thing.
It's
basically, it's a loop, right?
You just keep going through this process again. Maybe you go back and you interview the same customer base and you say, what do you need next? And then you test out your assumptions. You look for patterns, you create the next minimal viable product, and you pivot or double down. And this is the whole series of events here.
Yeah. And when you double down, you're usually going towards a business and you validate it. The business. You might even validate via the MVP or a little bit further whether people are willing to pay.
Okay, and you know what? And what I'm hearing you also say is, Andrew, there's certain solutions that are just so good that people would put up with a ghetto-rigged answer to them. Like, in my case, it's not so much the video platform, but if you were to handle all the relations for me with my sponsors and then plug those ads in at the right spot and then make sure that they were happy afterwards, I can't even think of how bad it could be. Even if you use the absolute worst video solution out there, skipped, people would deal with it, and I'd be happy with it because my sponsors are happy with it. And that's what you would say, okay, all these other assumptions didn't make sense. All he cares about is his relationships with his sponsors and that the audience has something that they could listen to. Boom, that's what we double down on, and we improve that, and we improve it until we've automated it to a place where it just all works beautifully for him.
Exactly.
One more question before we leave this process. As you're doing this, other people are watching you. They're seeing the mistakes. They're hearing people complain about Heaton or compliment Heaton, and they're seeing that you're going very slowly. What if they jump into the space and copy you and do something better?
Good luck to them.
Then you just let them have it at that point.
Well, I mean, that either means that you're poking in the wrong direction and you need to, you know, look at that and pivot because they're getting some customer successes. But I'd almost say that's one of the greatest things to happen for a number of reasons. One is a competitor validates your space. Two is when you have a competitor hop in and do something better, you have the opportunity to talk to their customers. No one says you can't go talk to their customers.
I see. So the same thing they did to you by figuring out what your customers like about your ghetto rig solution and created a less ghetto rig solution, you do back to them and you say, okay, you worked with me. You didn't like my system so much as you like my competitors. What is it about them that you liked? What drew you over to them?
Yeah, and there's a lot of ways you can do this. Like one of my favorite things to do, I'll put it out there. It's one of my favorite things to do actually is go look at other people's feedback forums. If I'm entering a space, the first thing I'll do is go on forums or Get Satisfaction or find their user voice forum and look at what their customers are voting on and saying about their product. A lot of times I'll get a lot of learnings there without even talking to a customer of theirs. On top of that, I'll know who their customers are when I look at those forums a lot of the time.
You know what? I've heard that. Those feedback tabs, and I've got them on my site and a lot of people have them on their site. They're a good way to let the audience know and vote on the problems, but they're also a good way for competitors to see what problems and what demands people have related to your business.
Yeah, in hindsight, I'm looking at yours right now, and it's like, people want interviews with small, profitable bootstraps. So if I was thinking of competing with you, I might just throw up a product, so to speak, in your space that just does that. That all I'm doing is interviewing small, profitable bootstraps.
You know what? Right? Absolutely right. Yes, if you were to do that, there are a lot of people who don't like that I interview venture-backed companies. There are a lot of people who don't like that I interview VCs. They just don't relate to it. They don't care for it. If you were to do just a bootstrap version of what I'm doing here, you're right. It would do very well, and many of my audience would actually go over to Heaton's program.
Yeah, sure. So I think it's like dumpster diving. That's what Andrew Carnegie said. That's awesome. Yeah. It is dumpster diving. I love dumpster diving.
Let me just clear this up, by the way. Andrew Carnegie didn't say dumpster diving, not the Andrew Carnegie. He's referring to Andrew Carnegie, the guy who took Andrew Carnegie's name in the chat room.
There you go.
I want to make sure that Andrew Carnegie's good name isn't sullied here. Okay, let's go back to the hosting company. The $500,000 that you invested in it, was that just your money that you earned?
Yes, in that case it was, yes.
How do you get to a place where you spend $500,000? That doesn't just happen overnight.
A lot of it was unique to our situation. We were running a successful consulting company and we had the money. And so we just kept pouring it into the idea. blindly. I'm super embarrassed about that one. So it just happened because we had other priorities. I mean, that's the other thing. If you're going to do one of these businesses, I think it's very important to focus fully on it.
Now, you guys have, in addition to Kissmetrics, are you still running Crazy Egg?
It's an independent company, so we have a few people running that. Neil and I are not running it day-to-day at the moment.
Okay. Are there any other companies that you guys launched that you still own?
No, it's just Crazy Egg, which is independent, and a couple products with Kissmetrics now.
Okay.
And the consulting is basically, there's a couple people doing it, but we don't do anything for it. It's just there. It's basically shut down.
And ACS, you guys have sold, or are you still own?
Yeah, that's the consulting company. We still own the name, but we don't have any clients.
All right, and that's another thing that you're saying, that you need to focus in. And that's what you guys have done. As soon as you got into Kissmetrics and you started understanding where you were going with this and the philosophy you're going to follow, you guys got rid of everything else and started to focus deep on this.
I think that's really important if you're in a situation where you have either a day job or a consulting business. I don't mean that you can't do the early customer discovery and even the minimum viable products without focusing, but when you catch a wave, if you figure out what a big need is, you need to ride it. And the only way you're going to do that is you're on one surfboard, not two.
All right, one more question before I move on past this hosting company. Where did the money go? What was the biggest expense there?
Good question. It's a very complicated situation, but I think the two biggest ones were infrastructure, so actual servers and routers and all that kind of fun stuff. And then the second one is employee maintenance costs. We had actually quite a few people working on that product.
Okay. I won't push anymore because I see that there's something uncomfortable about that story. What is it that's making you uncomfortable about it?
It's $500,000 down the drain. Like, literally, we didn't see a penny of it back. And we didn't really try to understand what the market wanted, or we didn't talk to customers before that. In fact, we never had a customer on that product, if I recall correctly, which was bad. And we wasted so much money. And when it would have been easy to, email site owners and ask them about the current hosting company they use, it was a very saturated market. So we could have easily done that.
Wow. Okay. All right. Can you give me one other business that you guys got into that didn't do so well?
Yeah, this one's great. I'm going to talk about it tonight. It was called Serph, SERPH.com. It's not live anymore. It took us 7 months, one developer, and $15,000 to build. We launched it in March of 2007, and it actually just recently, we took it offline in February of 2010. That was because we just got rid of the servers. So it was just running, and it didn't break. Almost 3 years. Yeah. But basically what it was, I don't know if you're familiar with the social media monitoring companies, but I believe we did social media monitoring before anyone else did with that product, which as time has told, or as we've seen 3 years later, there are successful businesses in the space. This is like Radian6, there's a company called Tracker, there's quite a few of these. Someone in the chat room, Mike B, says, 15K isn't so bad. Yeah, 15K might not be bad, but 7 months of one developer time is awful for especially this product. There's a number of reasons why that happened, but I would call that the biggest failure, not in terms of resources, in terms of money, but in terms of time. 7 months, one developer, I could have, with today's thinking and what I do today, could have tested a lot of products, but probably come up with one or two that would have been worth doubling, at least one that would have been worth doubling down on. Yeah, time is money.
How about one more?
Let me think.
Get this cup off the table.
Yes, I got a good one. So this one took me a second. So this one was another outsourced development thing. The Surf one that I talked about was in-house developer. But this is all he was working on for 7 months. Very embarrassing. The other one is we wanted to do, there's a lot of search engine management products. So when you're advertising on Google and Yahoo with keywords, a system to help you do the bidding and help you pick the keywords and stuff. So we wanted to build those really badly, especially because our consulting company was, you know, part of our business was based on managing those campaigns. So this is search marketing campaigns on Google and Yahoo and MSN and a bunch of other networks that were smaller. We probably spent $60,000 to $70,000 trying to build this product. It was out. It was another outsourced product with another development shop. It was called SiteBlimp. I don't think it's live anymore. We ended up just leaving these things live. I don't know why. But anyways, so that one, we spent that much money, and that one actually was interesting. I'm not sure if we could have saw what was coming, but I think we could have just spent less money in the process regardless. But basically what ended up happening is we wanted to provide a free plan to our customers, and we were relying on Google and Yahoo's APIs to make the whole business work because we needed data from them, and we needed to manipulate what people were doing. And then Google changed their policy. The first policy they changed is they didn't want their data next to Yahoo's data. So some of the big players apparently got around that, but we didn't because we didn't even have a customer, so we didn't matter to them. Second thing they did is they started charging their customers for the API calls. So it would have been extremely expensive being non-funded and so bootstrapped, so to speak, to kind of scale the free side of it. And that doesn't mean we couldn't have pivoted into like a paid plans and stuff like that. But for a number of those types of reasons, we stopped pursuing that project after wasting like $60,000 on it.
Why did Crazy Egg work of all the ideas that you guys tried?
Dumb luck.
Really?
Well, that's part of it. Another part of it is we try to get and this is not done based on any methodology. It's just what we felt was right after a lot of failures. We try to get on customers. We try to get customers really early, and we used very early. We got very smart about finding early adopters in the space. So one thing we did to build our email list for our beta invites was we advertised on a lot of the CSS galleries. And back then, the traffic was very inexpensive, and also there's a lot more of it than exists today. Now it's like very, really widespread, and people get their designers get their CSS kind of design fixes in other places, and it's not as hyped of a category anymore. And so we were able to grow a list to about 20,000 emails, and so we had a launch list with that, and we also had some private forums that we participated in where we gave invite codes very early. So my estimate is that without even using that 20,000 email list in our private alpha or beta, we probably had 1,000 to 2,000 people using the product, or at least that have signed up for it. And based on that, we were able to iterate the product. We didn't do any formal customer development or anything, but it was very similar, like understand customer needs, try to tune the product so it's better. There's a number of it was a very MVP product, and we took that process instead of spending a lot of time and energy building first. We built a minimum viable product. I think it took 3 or 4 months though, which I, in hindsight, I could have done faster. And we kind of went from there. So I think we took a very similar process to what I understand now about these lean startup principles and customer development, kind of without knowing what those things meant, just because I think success. Entrepreneurs, after a lot of failures and some successes, will tend to drive towards these kind of concepts on their own anyways, and that's what Neil and I ended up doing.
Okay. All right. And by the way, how do you explain Crazy Egg in one sentence?
It shows you where people click on your web pages.
Okay. All right. So then you discover Eric Ries's blog, like a lot of people did. But unlike most people, you actually used the ideas that he put out there with KISS metrics. Can you talk about how you did that?
Yeah, I'd say we're still trying to use the ideas, and we're doing our best. I wouldn't say that we're fully done with that. I think you're always constantly trying to be better and try to implement his ideas. I mean, a lot of the ideas are very iterative anyways. So over time, you get much, much better with it. And just like kind of the minimum viable product process, you're doing the same thing, which is like, how can someone spend an hour and make this process better in terms of, let's say, deploying code? So we'll spend very little time and start implementing things that he suggests around being able to deploy every minute if you wanted to, or all the time, so to speak. I would say that we also started doing a lot of customer interviews. So I have a typical, or not a typical, I have a personal problem, which is when I talk to customers, I don't write anything down. And it's just a weakness of mine. I've never been a good student at school around homework and writing things down. I wasn't the worst either, but anyways, I know people that cheated throughout a lot of stuff, and but I didn't, only half the stuff. But basically, what we would do is we would, what we've started doing is we've taken a lot of customer interviews, and we actually have someone who actually writes them down who's doing the interviews. This is Cindy Alvarez, who's our product manager now. And based on that, we try to find patterns and figure out what kind of features to build next. So we just try to implement as much of this stuff as possible over time and slowly. But the biggest part of it is actually writing things down, taking a very assumption, hypothesis, assumption, and validated learnings approach to things so that we're able to learn faster than, let's say, our competition and understand what these customer needs are. So I would say that it's more of taking to heart the concepts around knowing that you're not always right and being very comfortable with being wrong, almost wanting to be wrong.
All right, let's illustrate it with an example. Do you have an example of a project or a new product on KISS Metrics that you use these ideas on?
Yeah, we have quite a few. So we have turned this one into our second product. Our first one is KISS Metrics, the main product, which is a quantitative analytics tool helping people track conversion rates and funnels. A second assumption we had was quantitative data is great, but qualitative data like survey data and getting feedback from customers, whether it's satisfaction, get satisfaction user voice, or you know just feedback forms and things like that are really important. But we wanted to figure out what's a real opportunity in that. So what we did is we had a developer. I have this actual story. I'm just going to pull it up real quick. So we had a developer spend... So one developer spent 5 days building a minimum viable product for qualitative feedback. We had a number of assumptions. One of those assumptions was people don't know what to ask their customers. And then people don't know what actions take based on asking their customers that information. And then also, so that led to a product which was one template that's very simple. It's a couple things you fill in the blanks and we pop out the survey questions for you. What we did is we actually partnered with Sean Ellis. He has a blog, startup-marketing.com. I don't know if you've interviewed him, but you should. But basically, we partnered with him. He's a seasoned marketer. He has given this survey out to people, and he was very comfortable with us partnering and templating it. So what we do is it's survey.io is the URL. It only took 5 days to build, and it's had about 2,000 signups or more already, more than 2,000 signups. And that was our MVP. And we had a bunch of assumptions there. And the biggest one that was validated was, yes, people do not know what to ask customers. And when you tell them what to ask customers, they actually learn from it. And we weren't even trying to help them learn. We were just showing them the information. So we learned that. There's a couple other assumptions around that which was like, not even assumptions, just activity that we saw, which was these are long form surveys. And, you know, you don't get the highest percentage of responses on surveys when you have like 10 questions and things like that. We learned that, and we started actually, before we even really thought about that too much, we started building basically what you would call a SurveyMonkey competitor. Mm-hmm. So a tool that lets you build surveys or long form surveys. And, you know, for some reason, once we started, not even some reason, but we really started digging into it, and we realized that the majority of SurveyMonkey's competitors and the majority of reasons people use survey isn't to survey their customers. It's actually to survey their employees or do like market research surveys and things like that. And that wasn't the business we wanted to be in. We wanted to build a product that helped you understand your customer better. And so we kind of built the product that was like SurveyMonkey kind of competitor. And then what we decided to do was actually do a really quick MVP test on this. And what we did was we spent 2 days to tweak the product a little bit and started doing pop-up surveys on web pages. And that was a blast. So we saw the response rate was much higher. We started getting very, like, in our own team, we started thinking of, I don't want to say hundreds, but dozens of questions we wanted to ask customers in certain places. So one of the key ones we did was, in our KISS Metrics product, we used our minimum viable product for surveys and asked, in the report interface, is this report clear? yes or no. And if they said no, we asked them to explain their answer. So that actually helped us improve the interface. And so we started realizing that this was a really good way to get feedback. And now we've built a product on it. It's called Kiss Insights. It's in beta. That product took 2 months to build. And we've had about 500 signups so far. And I don't know if we have product market fit with that idea yet, but we're working on it. So I just got a spammy message on Skype. Datethewives.com.
I've been getting a lot of those. It's very distracting during interviews. So it's like a Russian bride service or a woman who's just so in love with me that she needs to contact me. And I wish that there was better spam protection on Skype.
It's just someone's minimum viable product. It's okay.
Okay, so right. I see. So now, does this integrate with Kiss Metrics? When I saw that you guys were doing Survey.io, I said, Neil and Heaton just keep pumping out products, and this is just another product that they're creating, another business, kind of like some of the businesses we talked about earlier. But you're saying it's not. How does this integrate with Kiss Metrics?
Our goal with Kiss Metrics is to help people get actionable information about their customers. So basically information they can take action on. And having these two products helps us marry qualitative and quantitative information, which is really crucial in improving basically the experience for your customers and improving your product. So they're actually very tied together and very complementary. I think we're still months away from really tying them together in a meaningful way, but we see at the end of the road, we see a lot of that going on.
Let's see what else I've got here on my list. I'm looking up at the time and I see that we're almost at an hour, but I want to squeeze much more in here. Okay, here's a question that I held off till the end. You guys are non-developers. How do two non-developers build a business that's so heavily reliant on developing?
We try to hire a lot of people, and based on that, we found people that we can get along with and people that are really good at making products. So it was just trial and error.
How do you manage people as a non-developer? How do you manage their code and make sure that they're developing in the right way and so on?
It's a great question. I do it by finding people I can trust and giving them very small projects to do. So if I were to start today, I'd give somebody a very small project to do and see if they can successfully do it in a short amount of time, and if when I go through it, it works. So it's a very simple way. I wouldn't even try to audit their code. I'm just looking for someone that can put something out there extremely fast and it works. It might break a little bit here and there, but they're willing to fix it. They're fixing it fast. So I think it's more of an attitude. For me, it's more of an attitude, not a skill thing. So if someone has the right attitude, I'd probably lean towards that person than someone who has the right skill with the wrong attitude.
Is there one person that you've come to rely on to be your main developer, the guy who helps you understand what everyone else is doing?
Yes and no. Usually in a startup, you're going to hire, if you're not a business guy, you're going to have to hire some sort of VP of engineering, CTO, that type of guy, lead engineer. So that's the kind of guy I would rely on. I actually think for different areas in our business, I rely on different people. So for design, I rely on the designer. These days, actually, our product manager is doing a lot of the kind of work that I used to do, and I used to do really poorly. She does it much better than I do, so I have luxury of in the middle of the day doing an interview with you.
I know, last minute. Thank you so much, by the way, for jumping in here last minute.
No, I enjoy it.
Eric Reese, by the way, I've got just a couple more questions here.
Sure.
Eric Reese, he started out by writing about these ideas, then he started putting together little events across the country, and now what's this event that you guys are sponsoring later this week?
Yeah, it's the first conference about the Lean Startup stuff, Lean Startup principles. So a lot of people that are practicing it are coming together, and I think a lot of people that are aspiring to, learn how to build successful businesses in an iterative sort of, kind of increase the odds sort of fashion are going to show up. I think it's going to be a really exciting event, and we'll get a lot of, a lot of the things that I talked about here, I'm actually not talking about there. It's more about, I'm actually going to get pretty deep into the pivots and our specific reasoning around our pivots with Kiss Metrics, because we've actually had three iterations of the Kiss Metrics product. And so I think a lot of people are going to share things that you haven't heard before. And it's not just going to be Eric sharing things, it's going to be other people as well. I'm pretty excited about it. I'm looking forward to hearing what some of the other kind of startups and entrepreneurs have to say about what they've learned trying to implement these things and taking this process.
And the talks are all going to be about lean startups, lean startup ideas in action by the people who are using them?
You got it, exactly.
By the way, that pivot is something that I haven't been able to do a good enough job on in my interviews. We all know how important the pivot is, but it's hard to find those stories that show how people have pivoted properly. I'm really looking forward to hearing how you did that. And
go ahead.
You were going to say that you're going to send me the presentation, but people can also see – I'm not selling this, by the way. I don't get a cut of any of this. I'm just really genuinely curious, and I'm assuming anyone who listened all this way into the interview is also curious about this. If we're not at the conference, can we see these videos somewhere online afterwards?
Yeah, I think they're going to be recorded, and you can probably see them afterwards, knowing how Eric rolls. He loves to share all the information. But there's also some simulcasts that are going on in like, I think, 50 different areas.
Where people get together and all watch together.
Yes, exactly. I think if you go to slconf.com, you'll be able to see it. And I just realized that Justin TV is going to be, it'll be streamed on Justin TV as well. They're sponsoring an event and they're going to be streaming it.
Okay. You said earlier that you had a lot of ideas for businesses. Do you have one that you would do right now if you had the time? But you can't do, and maybe we'll give to the audience?
Great question. I have way too many ideas. And I think, honestly, I'm gonna throw it back at you and say that, like, if it's not really about me giving an idea, because I can come up with some random idea, like, every minute of the day. I think it's more about taking some random idea and really validating whether it's a good idea or not. And that's really more important than an idiot like me giving someone an idea or saying some idea I'd like to see built. I'm not any smarter than any other entrepreneur or aspiring entrepreneur out there. I think it's more about having an idea and really being passionate about, you know, kind of wanting to see it through and then wanting to learn more and more. So with our own ideas, I have a strong passion for helping businesses understand data better, whether it's qualitative or quantitative. And that's where all of our products come out of. And they're deeply rooted in that vision of wanting people to kind of do better with metrics and measurement and feedback and things like that, and tie it back into improving products. So most of my ideas all fall around that. So I'd say that pick an idea. It's not the idea that really matters as much. It's more that you're taking an idea and really willing to say I'm wrong or I'm right about it. So for example, for the longest time, based on the amount of money SurveyMonkey made, I wanted to go compete with them. You know, and we're not competing with them at all now. And it's the best move for the business, and it's based on learning what the customer need was, but deeply rooted in what vision that we have for our business and for kind of what we want to be at the end of the day.
I see. Instead of just chasing other people's ideas, you found a way to make it yours, to make
exactly.
It fit with your mission.
You got it.
By the way, I see you constantly focusing on KISS metrics. I see Neil Patel advising your partner, advising a billion different companies, putting up blog posts, taking pictures everywhere. Is he working on the business as long and as hard as you are?
Yeah, absolutely.
He's full-time in the business.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he is, so I'm more focused on product and development, and he's more focused on sales and marketing. So that can probably sum up the kind of stuff he does, which makes you feel like he's not doing anything. Mm-hmm. But if you looked at what I do every day, you'd think I wasn't doing anything either. So,
all right. I don't mean to say that he's not doing anything. I just don't understand how he's doing it all. And I'm wondering what his role is.
It's all sales and marketing. So when we don't have a product that needs to be aggressively marketed, he's basically generating demand, which is why you see him everywhere, so to speak.
If that makes sense. I do see him everywhere. I don't understand how he could be on the phone with me for half hour helping me think through an idea and at the same time blogging all the time, working with white pages, working with a bunch of other people. Moses in the audience is saying that I'm instigating something. Maybe. We'll see. All right. Any final words?
No. I think, you know, I said it in the video from the conference I said it how I wanted to, which is like, everyone should be following these principles. You want to at least start. If you're confused about where to start, just start somewhere, right? These things have changed the way I think about business. I'm very much more confident about building successful startups with these principles and without them. I wish I would have you know, known about them and practiced them years
Bottom
ago.
line, what has it done for you at Kissmetrics? What have the lean startup ideas done for Kissmetrics?
Increased our chances for success, for building a really big business.
All right. Leave it there. Guys, thank you all for watching. We've talked about a lot of people who've done past interviews here. Sean Ellis, I think I might have asked him once for an interview a long time ago, but we couldn't figure out a date. I don't remember. But Eric Reese has done an interview here. This is Heaton Shaw's second interview here. You can go back and find the interview that he did back when he was at ACS. Neil Patel did an interview here. You should also check out all of their websites, especially Startup Lessons Learned, which is Eric Reese's site. And I said earlier that everyone's demanding more bootstrapped entrepreneurs. I'm giving you more bootstrapped entrepreneurs, and I'm putting out a call constantly for more of them. So if you're a bootstrapped entrepreneur who's had a good amount of success, I'm not just looking for somebody who's bootstrapping for the sake of bootstrapping. I need it to be a successful business. Come back out here, send me an email, and we'll do an interview with you. And I've got many lined up for you guys, including one who I won't promote it. I want to get him on here and surprise you guys. All right, Heaton Shaw, everyone for watching, thank you. See you guys.